Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Dr. Zed Chu and Ken Miller. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and Dr. Miller specializes in pain and palliative care. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Dr. Miller speaks with Dr. Janet Abram, Associate Professor of Medicine and Anesthesia at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Dr. Abram is the author of A Physician's Guide to Pain and Symptom Management in Cancer Patients.
Janet, thanks for being with us tonight.
Oh, you're very welcome.
So I've got to make a little disclosure here. I have to say, you know, I was thinking there are some books that you literally keep on your shelf,
mm-hmm.
and there's other books you keep on your desk,
uh-huh.
and your book is one I keep on my desk.
Oh, that's great.
And look, so thank you very much for writing it.
I'm really glad it's useful. That's what I wrote it for.
Well, terrific. I think in the past, symptom management and palliation of symptoms was not the biggest emphasis in medicine. So if you would, just tell us a little bit about your career and sort of what you've seen in terms of the field of palliative care.
Well, the field of palliative care is a brand new one, and it's evolved over about the last 10 years, I think. Certainly when I trained in oncology, there was no field of palliative medicine, and there really wasn't even that much pain management.
Yeah.
I really think that one of the impetuses for the development of the field of palliative care in the United States was the Kevorkian situation. There were a lot of very compassionate feeling doctors who thought people should not have to choose death if they were suffering, and that there should be a specialty designed to help people who were suffering while they were trying to be cured of their disease or live as long as possible. The hospice movement was there mm-hmm. from the 60s, and certainly Branford was the first hospice in the United States, as I understand it.
Yeah.
So Connecticut is definitely, and Yale is definitely a pioneer. But in terms of palliative medicine, it's more of the academic thrust of the hospice and palliative care movement. So what happened was Kathy Foley and some of the leaders in the country got together and decided what we need is to bring together people who are interested in developing this area of medicine in terms of research, education, clinical practice. They got some funding from George Soros
mm-hmm.
With the Open Society Institute and formed something called the Project on Death in America, to use the word death.
Which I have to say is not a term that we use very often, either in the hospital or in the oncology clinic.
Exactly, and that's also when Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was doing her work.
Yep, yep.
And when she went into hospitals to ask to interview dying patients, they would say, "Well, there aren't any dying patients here." So, by bringing together people from all over the country, there were faculty scholars led by Dr. Susan Block.
Mm-hmm.
And 10 to 12 of us a year, over a number of years, were brought together, found that we weren't the only ones who really wanted to partner with oncologists and cardiologists and neurologists and people who are dealing with people with very advanced disease. We wanted to partner with them in helping people find meaning in their lives, decrease their suffering, help them decide about the goals of care. And we felt that to do that, we had to have an official specialty.
Let me ask you a question that I've been asked before.
Sure.
and get your sense on this. I mean, I remember vividly a patient coming to me and saying, Dr. Miller, I have cancer, and what can you do to get this over with quicker?
Mm.
You know, and it was early in my career, and I remember it to this day. But how do you respond to that?
Well, I think asking for a hastened death is one of the hardest questions that a physician is asked to do. There's a very interesting paper by Drs. Block and Billings about this called Responding to Patient Requests for Hastened Death.
Mm-hmm.
And from that I learned that that's often a cry for help.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing I do is say, tell me more about your suffering. Tell me more about that request. Do you have pain or another symptom that isn't being dealt with?
Mm-hmm.
Are you worried about losing control, about what's going to happen as this goes forward? Tell me what you see in the future. I want to be there with you. I want to be sure that that road is populated by people and the services you need. I like to find out if the patient is worried that their family won't be there for them, or if they've seen someone suffer and they don't know that there's relief for that suffering. So I like to unpack that question, find out what pieces of it I can help.
I have to say the term of saying I want to be there with you is really a lovely one, you know, because that's really what it is. It's taking a walk with someone. It's being with them.
Yeah, and I think that that's sometimes just a cry for help. You're not paying attention to me. The organ experience has shown that the people who really do want to hasten their deaths, often it's not an issue of uncontrolled symptoms. It's not that their finances are a problem. They're not worried about spending their last dollar. It's not that their families aren't there. It is more a matter of control. And just having the means to do it sometimes enables them to live as long as anybody else would. Very few people actually avail themselves of that option once given the medications.
One of the things you talk about a lot in your book is goals of care. So along those lines, you know, what are the goals of care, you know, that are open to people?
Goals of care is, when I first heard that term, I thought, what is a goal of care? I mean, a goal of care? I suppose is cure, you know. The first goal is, well, can I be cured? Another goal is, could my life be prolonged as long as possible? And as an oncologist and hematologist for 20 years, those were my goals. But I think in palliative care, what we do is broaden that definition. And so in addition to living as long as you can, we want to see if people want to live as well as they can. We also want to find out, what are the things you need to get done? Because hopelessness that people worry about a lot is really a lack of purpose. So that what we're talking about in goals of care is there are some things that are worse than dying for some people. And there's a burden to several treatments. So what we want to find out is, if your goals are to finish a book or to take a special trip with your family or to be at home with your family and to really cement relationships, there might be treatments that would be more of a burden than a benefit to you, either financially or having to come in every week for a treatment. So we need to let you know that your doctor is not going to abandon you no matter what you choose, that relationship is there, and that your doctor and nurse team, your oncology team, is very concerned. And I'm speaking as an oncologist, but this applies to, you know, any advanced disease, be it liver disease, lung disease, heart disease, neurologic disease. People worry that if they don't take a treatment, that their treatment team will treat other patients. And they worry about their right, if you will, to take the place in that room. So we try to explore with people and their families, how can this treatment help you? What are your goals? What family events are coming up? Because people, at least in cancer treatment, kind of only have the cancer calendar. No more birthdays, Thanksgiving. If you try to suggest to someone that maybe we could delay the treatment until after Thanksgiving, they may say, are you trying to kill me? I mean, we need to bring their lives back in. And we need to say to them, we are happy to give you treatments that will work just as well, but that will fit around the important events of your life, your 40th anniversary, the graduation. So those are part of the goals of care.
Now, when you and other clinicians open up these conversations, I mean, some of this is new territory for people. They're not used to talking about these things. But so how do patients, people do with all this in terms of sharing these kind of feelings?
That's a very interesting question. I used to be worried about that. Because I was so used to asking people, for example, if they had breast cancer, I would ask, well, when did you find the lump and what treatment did you get? I never asked, how did you feel when you found the lump? Well, it turns out that people are very happy to share that information. Not always with their oncologist, though. I've trained many clinicians, and many of them are oncologists or oncology nurse practitioners as well as palliative care skilled. And they tell me that when they're the oncologist, the patients and families don't want to talk about this that often with them. They want them to fight for them. They want to talk about the treatment. So I think what's important is to partner with the palliative care team because the patients do want to talk about this. And so as the palliative care doctor, when I talk about this, they are very happy to share with me their fears and their hopes. They're happy to share what they're afraid to tell their doctor about. They may have already thought about hospice treatment, but don't want to let their doctor down. I've heard that so many times. She's tried so hard. She cares about me so much. I would just hate to let her down by telling her that I wanted to think about hospice so that I could be at home and my family would get the support they need.
You know, as you're talking, I'm thinking of an analogy of a, you know, a sports team, a football team. And, you know, if a football player who's out there trying to win the game were to tell their coach that, you know, they've got a problem at home, would the coach not be rooting for them as much or rooting for the team? And does that strike a chord at all?
It completely strikes a chord. I think most patients want to be the patient you want, you're happiest to see. Especially people who come to places like Dana-Farber and places like Yale Cancer Center, any cancer center. These are the people who are selected because they want to go and get the best treatment. So the face they put on for the doctor is, I want it, I'm with it, I'm for it. They may not even tell them that they might not want to be resuscitated because they don't want to be a quitter.
Yeah.
The way we find out is when they go to get their treatment, they tell the nurse how much pain they're in. And the nurse will call us. So it totally is, they need someone fighting for them, and they want to be that good patient.
So let's take it a step further from the onco, because you wear two hats. You're an oncologist.
Sure.
You're a palliative care specialist. Wearing your oncology hat, if a patient were to say to you, Doc, you know what? I want to be fighting the cancer, but you know what? I have a birthday coming up, or it's my 40th anniversary. I mean, do you feel less engaged with fighting the battle?
I think it's even harder than that. I don't think the patient's going to tell you that.
Yeah, yeah.
I honestly don't. So what I think you need to do, if you can, and I think you can, you and your team, because most people have a team. They either work with social workers or nurses. Or what you can do is make it clear to the patient that you care about those issues as well. So if you have your 15 minutes, and that's about all anybody has anymore.
Right.
Is you can say to the patient, we are definitely going to talk about your treatment. I'm going to tell you the results of all your tests. But it's very important to me to know how you're feeling, how you're doing. And I want to integrate this treatment with your life. Because the more energy you get from your family and from those things that make life worth living, the more energy you'll have to fight the cancer. And if you're feeling low or if you're having pain, that takes energy away from your fight against the cancer.
So
you need to tell me about that so I can get you some help for that.
So really, in many ways, these dialogues really help people to battle. They really don't. In no way do they stop them.
And they definitely help them. Think of all that energy you spend keeping that closet door closed.
That's
you know?
Right. Yeah.
And it's very important to say, tell me about that pain. You know, tell me about if you're feeling low and it's really hard to get up in the morning, because I want you to get the help you need so that we are spending all your energy fighting this cancer.
Well, we'd like to remind you, please email questions and thoughts that you have to canceranswers@yale.edu. We're going to take a short break for a medical minute, and then please stay tuned to learn more information about compassionate care and supportive care and palliative care with Dr. Janet Abram.
Here in Connecticut, the American Cancer Society estimates that almost 1,000 people will be diagnosed with colorectal cancer every month. The good news is that when you detect it early, colorectal cancer is easily treated and highly curable. That means if you're over the age of 50, you should have regular colonoscopies to screen for this disease. In the case of patients that develop colorectal cancer, there are more options than ever before thanks to increased access to advanced therapies and specialized care. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for colorectal cancer. Patients enrolled in these trials are given access to medicines not yet approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Ken Miller, and I'm here with Dr. Janet Abram from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute discussing symptom management for cancer patients. Janet, we've been talking about supportive care issues and symptom management. What are some of the barriers that prevent patients, families, and doctors from engaging in caring for people's symptoms?
Well, one of the biggest barriers that patients and families have is that they assume that cancer comes with pain mm-hmm. and suffering. In terms of pain, many of them are afraid that if they treat the pain, they won't know if the cancer is getting better.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very important to explicitly say, we have other measures to see if your cancer is getting better. We don't need the pain.
Mm-hmm.
So please treat the pain. They're certainly afraid of getting addicted
yep.
to opioids.
Mm-hmm.
The common term is narcotics. They're afraid of being addicted. They're afraid of being doped up.
Mm-hmm.
They're afraid they won't be able to drive their cars. And you have to reassure them. One of the phrases I used to use is, you're not going to start stealing TV sets
okay.
if you take this stuff.
Uh-huh. Well, and now we have you on record as saying that.
Absolutely, absolutely. Because cancer patients aren't. I mean, yes, there are patients who have a history of abuse, mm-hmm. and you have to be careful with those and work with a team to support them. But a big barrier would be if there was somebody with abuse in the family, and that's what they imagined would happen to them if they took the medications. For families, one of the issues tends to be that they don't want to see the disease getting worse,
mm-hmm.
so they will sometimes under-medicate the patient because seeing the pain means seeing the disease getting worse.
Mm-hmm.
It's also complicated to take the medications, and it's expensive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So insurance is a huge barrier. In some states, you still have to write triplicates,
yes.
so doctors don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. In other states, in the New England area, New Hampshire, for example, there are limits on the number of pills in a given prescription.
Which is the case here in Connecticut.
It
You're
is.
Right.
So that if you need flexibility to treat pain, the doctors are really hampered by how many prescriptions. And it can be shameful
mm-hmm.
to go to the pharmacy and get a drug like methadone, which is actually quite wonderful for patients with nerve pain.
Mm-hmm.
But think how shameful it can be when the pharmacist doesn't understand that or when everybody around you thinks you're an addict.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of stigmas to getting pain relief.
I want to talk a little bit more about families. And one of the things you talk about in your book and lecture on as well is compassion fatigue. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, compassion fatigue is something that happens more to clinicians,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
though it can certainly happen to families. But it's mostly it comes about when a clinician or a counselor is faced with ongoing suffering
mm.
that they cannot fix, and that they have expectations that they can fix it.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're in a situation that doesn't allow them to debrief at all.
Mm-hmm.
When I was an intern and I was in the ICU, there could be five different people who were in that same bed in one night who died.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to take care of five different people in a night who died. And I never got to talk about it the next day. It's not something we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're an oncologist, or if you deal with people who are suffering a lot, like counselors of rape victims, mm-hmm. people like that, and you don't have enough time, and you don't have a place to talk about it, and you don't feel that you're in control of what's happening, you stop feeling it.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a nurse, for example, who's working with physicians, unfortunately this still happens, who really don't understand well enough how to use opioids and other pain medications,
mm-hmm.
and you have a floor full of cancer patients in pain, you stop answering the bell.
Mm-hmm.
You can't see that pain anymore. It hurts too much. And those become rooms for us as physicians that we just don't want to enter.
Mm-hmm.
and we become numb, and we stop feeling. That's what compassion fatigue is. It makes it so that you can't talk to families anymore because it hurts too much. Mm-hmm. And the cure for that is to have a forum that honors that suffering. Maybe even making rounds on the empty bed, as a wonderful professor of mine, an ICU professor, John Hansen Flashen, pulmonary doctor down at Penn, also his whole team down there. They would make rounds on the empty bed. We would talk about what happened the night before, what it felt like. We at Harvard now do grief rounds for our oncology interns so that they can talk about what it's like taking care of those patients. And we can honor that commitment. I think I as an oncologist benefited from having the nurses especially and other colleagues be able to talk about the hard deaths or the suffering. As palliative care docs, we do that all the time.
Yeah.
We're there for our colleagues because we know how hard it is, and that every bit of energy you want as a physician or a nurse is to fight the cancer. Mm-hmm. But we want to honor how hard it is and how much it hurts. And if you do that, if you grieve, if you help your families in bereavement and you see that they heal, you can grieve. You have to grieve, as hard as it is. You have to feel that pain, and then you can heal, and then you can go on. Without that, if you keep, as I did in my youth, I put it all away. And after a while, it's just too hard. I had this strange habit of grieving in symphonies. I would go to the symphony, and in the slow movements, I would think about the patients and the families, and that worked for a while, until I became an oncology fellow, or an oncology attending. And then I remember one summer, my husband, we used to go out to Robin Hood Dell in Philadelphia. It was wonderful. You'd go in the summer, you'd sit out, and he would say, well, let's go to the concert tonight. And I said, I just can't deal with that tonight. And he said, but it's Mozart. What's there to deal with? And then I realized I couldn't deal with the litany of my grief, that I had to find another place for it.
Let me, talking about the issue of bereavement, I mean, you raise an interesting point that loss is not just for the families. It's also for the doctors, too.
Yes. We have relationships with our patients, and some we identify with more than others. But if we blame ourselves for each loss, if we don't realize that it's medicine's failure, it's not our failure. And in the sadness of our patients' faces, we read anger or disappointment with us, instead of what it really is just their grief and their sadness.
Yeah.
Or if we read that into the faces of the nurses who are just sad. I think we project sometimes our own feelings of impotence or grief, and we feel that we failed. I think we have to understand that we haven't failed, and we haven't abandoned the patient. We have to understand that what they're hoping for from us is for us to be there, not to withdraw as they're dying, not to emotionally withdraw, but to be a we with them, as Eric Cassell talks about. If we can be there with them, and we can be emotionally there with them, and then we can find our own ways to grieve with our colleagues or in a movie or walking or playing squash or whatever it is we do, we'll be present for our patients. That's what they want from us.
How do we empower, for people that are listening, and all of us will face at one time or another a serious illness or some trouble in life, but how do we empower our patients to make that connection with their own clinicians?
I think that if patients want to make that connection, it's just easier to tell the clinician. If you don't feel you can tell the doctor, tell the nurse, tell the secretary, tell somebody that what I need from you, doctor, is for you to be here with me. I don't expect you to work miracles. I'd like you to work miracles.
You bet.
And I want to live as long as possible, but I want to be part of the conversation. And I'd like it if you would let me know not just the risks of the treatment, but what burden it's going to be on me and my family. And I'd really appreciate it if I could talk to you about those things. If we could live my life along with the treatment. I know this sounds weird to you. It doesn't mean I'm not a fighter. I am a fighter.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a fighter with you. But it'll help me to fight if I can see as clearly as you do, not in a medical way. I know you're the expert.
Mm-hmm.
But if there's some way you can help me, if I can read something or if you can help me understand what you need from me,
mm-hmm.
and if I feel free to tell you what I need from you, would that be okay?
I mean, they're powerful words, and they're beautiful words, really. You know, there's a concept of growth at the end of life, and it's not what people typically think of, but what does that mean? The opportunity for growth.
I do want to say, just from that last question, there's a new book out from the American Cancer Society for patients and their families. I don't recall the name at the moment, but it's written by a wonderful collection of people, Kathy Foley, and others. So maybe physicians or could have that in their offices
mm-hmm.
for their patients, or the patients could try to find it, or Joanne Lynn's book, Mortal Lessons.
Mm-hmm.
Those are books that can help you understand what's possible. Now, growth at the end of life. What we're talking about there is that when you find that you may have a limited time to live, if time may be short, as Susan Block says, what if time were short? It starts you and your family thinking about, well, what are the things that need to get done? And Ira Byock talks about this too. What are the things I need to be sure to say?
Mm-hmm.
Do I need to thank somebody? Do I need to give somebody forgiveness? Do I need forgiveness?
Mm-hmm.
Do I need to tell people I love them? What is my legacy for my family, for the world? What are the things that really matter to me? And in doing so, some people find that they are growing in the breadth and depth of their worldview.
Mm-hmm.
And they find it satisfying, meaningful. And their families take that with them forever. So do their doctors. When patients say goodbye to me, and I say goodbye to patients, I find that I take them with me.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that they give me a gift, and that they feel very good about that gift, sometimes as a teacher, sometimes just as a gift that they can give.
It's a lovely thing, and I have to, you know, as I look back on the last 20 years of my own practice, but the people that I remember most are the ones, my patients, that have shared a gift of one form or another, an insight, a personal moment, a little part of their life and who they are.
Exactly.
Yeah, so it is wonderful to think about this as being a partnership, you know, between doctors and patients, and we're all people.
And I think that maybe what holds us back from the partnership is the fear of the pain, of the loss.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that as we learn to process that loss and honor it, I think that we're able to connect in more meaningful ways and be more open to our patients and have a much more satisfying practice.
Well, actually, I want to thank you very much for being with us tonight. Again, Dr. Janet Abram, who's an associate professor at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Harvard up in Boston. This has been a wonderful program. And until next week, this is Dr. Ken Miller from the Yale Cancer Center wishing all of you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions, comments, or would like to subscribe to our podcast, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you'll also find transcripts of past broadcasts in written form. Next week, we'll meet Dr. Marion Mora, chair of the American Cancer Society's Board of Directors.